One person came up and said, hey, I had to put the book down for a second because I finally saw my polyamory on the page and it was overwhelming.
If you're happy with the same old ways of dating,
if you enjoy sucking at communication,
and you have no desire to improve your romantic life, then our podcast might not be for you.
But if you want some out-of-the-box ideas to deepen your current relationships,
broaden your sexual horizons,
develop a better understanding of yourself,
or learn more about non-monogamy,
then you've come to the right place. I'm Jace.
I'm Emily.
And I'm Dedeker.
And this is the Multiamory Podcast. On this episode of the Multiamory Podcast, we're very excited to have Kevin Patterson back on the show, along with his co-author, Alana Phelan. Together, they wrote a book that just came out a couple months ago called For Hire, Operator, which is a cool sci-fi book. We're going to have them tell you more about it, but it exists in a world where there's polyamorous and queer people all over the place, and it's fantastic. We're really excited to have them back on the show. So Alana Phelan is a writer, editor, librarian, and community organizer. She offers everything from advice to dating events to relationship support coaching through her website, The Polyamorous Librarian. And Kevin Patterson has been practicing non-monogamy for many years, and in April of 2015, he started the interview series blog, Poly Role Models, and his first book, Love's Not Colorblind, which we talked about on this show a few months back, covers the intersection of race, polyamory, and community. And with that, let's get into the interview. And here we are with Kevin and Alana. Thank you so much for being here.
Hey, glad to be back.
Yeah.
So we're very excited to talk about your book, For Hire Operator, that just came out like a month ago now. No, I guess, well, 2 months ago, probably by the time this episode drops, at least that, right?
Yeah, about mid-October.
Mid-October. Okay, cool. So it's been out for a little while. We've all read it, and we're super excited to talk about it.
Yes! But I'm so excited to talk to somebody who already had a chance to read it.
Yeah, totally.
Oh, we all finished it.
Yeah.
And so could we start off by you giving us like the quick pitch version of what the book is all about for our listeners at home?
So it's a love story, a superhero novel, a representation novel, but it's about two women who have been together since high school. They are both superhuman, but they employ their superhumanity in two different ways. One of them is a superhero, which is pretty self-explanatory. The other is an operator, which is more of a hero for hire, legal dirty work sort of superhuman. And both of them are top-notch at what they do, but they're at such different ends of the superhuman spectrum in terms of what they're using their powers for that it causes friction in their relationship. And then, you know, the operator, who the book is titled after, goes on a job for her favorite client and things quickly go completely off the rails. Mm.
Got it. And also, just for our listeners to know, like Kevin said, this is very much a representation novel as well, that, you know, it's a full cast of plenty of non-white people, queer people, gender non-conforming people, a variety of non-traditional relationships, represented in a way that I find was very, very normalized, as opposed to how it pops up in most fiction, which is like, this one gender nonconforming person shows up either as like the token representation, or, oh, there's these weirdos over here who have a triad. But it seemed like in the world where your novel was set, that all these things were like very, very normal and day to day.
So, yeah, absolutely. That's one of the things that I loved about what Kevin created when he started this universe, is that everything is, if it's not completely normalized, at least it's a lot closer to normalized than we see in the real world.
Right, totally. Well, I was kind of curious, actually, if you could tell us a little bit about like how this story came about and how you two ended up working together on this.
Well, to start, the last time I was on this podcast, I was talking about Love's Not Colorblind.
Yeah.
And I was about halfway into it, and I just needed sort of like a mental break, and I took some time off, And it was really weird because, like, Love's Not Colorblind from start to finish took me about 8 to 9 months. But the first draft of For Hire, which I did sort of in the middle, it took me barely a month. I wrote a longer book that I thought no one would ever read.
Yeah, okay, hang on. Sorry. So you wrote another book in the process of writing Love's Not Colorblind.
Dedeker is flabbergasted.
I wrote a book.
He's like, what can I say? I don't know.
In case you want to read a book while you are reading your book.
There you go.
I feel really like an underachiever now.
Well, so it makes me think that really what we should have done is read Love Is Not Colorblind, take a break in the middle to read this one, and then go back.
There you go.
Wow, that's a super fan edition. If somebody decides they want to do that, like, I'll work out some sort of prize for that human. So
that's awesome.
Let's just put that out there.
That's fantastic.
Oh my goodness.
And then so Alana, how did you get involved in that process?
Well, when Kevin finished it, he sort of handed it off to me and said, hey, you're a librarian. What do you think? And I read a couple pages and said, can you hand it to me when it's done? And he was kind of like, that hurt. And so he came back to me a little while later after he had been doing the tour, the Love's Not Colorblind tour, and said, like, no, I really love this book and I really need you on this to look at it to see how to make it its best self. And so we started collaborating, talking about it, seeing how what was working and what wasn't. And at some point I started writing a scene or two, editing a lot. I cut the first half of the book, which was...
Yeah. Oh, wow. Really?
The first half of the book.
I did. Wow. So you're reading now is basically an expanded second half of the book. And then the first half of the book is probably something we're going to revisit sooner. But what's going on in this story, everything from the beginning was kind of a backstory and could stand on its own. Both stories could stand on their own. And I told Kev, this is the story that you want to tell, this one right here. And so I ended up a co-writer.
Wow.
Yeah. We essentially took a 50,000-word first draft, cut 25,000 words out of it,
then
took the remaining 25,000 and made it about 65,000 words.
Got it.
That's the book that you have.
Wow.
The book actually starts... I mean, the first draft starts with our two main characters meeting as teenagers and creating their own path to superhumanity. And we got rid of all of that. So, book 3 or 4 or 5 might be an origin story for these two characters.
Wow. Nice.
I see. So interesting. So, I mean, Kev, for you, was that a difficult process? Kind of, it's the whole trope of like murder your darlings. Process? Yeah, it hurt.
It hurt. I mean, like, something that works with Elena and I and our dynamic is that she doesn't really pull any punches with me. And while it hurts, it results in a better product. So when she said, okay, well, your book actually starts here in chapter 11, Kev, I was just like, wow, okay, well, I could have argued and put out, I could have argued and had a worse book, but instead I let it ride, cut 10 chapters out of a book, and then retooled the rest of it. And I'm really proud of what we put out.
Awesome. He was super great about it though. Like, he's the one who really realized where the book started. Like, I asked him, where's your inciting incident, which is, the thing that kicks off the book. And he's the one who looked at it critically and said, it's in chapter 11.
Nice.
Yeah. Uh-huh. I did want to expand on something that Dedeker talked about earlier, which is also that, like, in terms of normalization, things like good kink etiquette and just communication, consent, like all of those things also seem to be something that these characters just like inherently are good at. So was there a reasoning behind why you decided, like, okay, just people in this book just universally are going to be great at these types of things, or just more evolved, I think, than perhaps our current society certainly is?
The two of us are polyamorous, but also, like, because of the work I do, I find myself in a lot of sex ed circles. And I realize there's so much that representation gets wrong, just little things that, you know, if you find yourself in sex ed circles as much as I do, like there are little things that we do that work and then get missed completely. Like, just basic example, She's Gotta Have It, that was on Netflix last year.
Yeah.
You know, there was zero talk of safe sex in that show until the ninth episode. Meanwhile, if the main character had a bowl of condoms just next to the bed, you wouldn't even have to have that conversation.
Yeah.
So we wanted to make sure that we were leaving in little things, like just basic, recognition of, like you said, kink etiquette or safer sex practices. Things that are normalized to us that should be normalized in general. Mm-hmm. We wanted to make sure we planted those in there.
Yeah, I mean, someone got rejected and then they said, thank you for taking care of yourself. And that was just in there and it was lovely and very normal. And it was very refreshing, truly, to see that and not have it be like a big thing. So it would be nice if all books were written in such a manner.
I read a meme or I saw like a Facebook thread or something recently where somebody was talking about that asking for consent isn't sexy or something like that.
Oh, and I think that was me talking about a conversation I'd had with someone about a partner they had.
And it's like maybe not the way that you ask for consent.
Yeah, exactly. Literally, that must be the case.
Yeah, like I've never had that problem. Like I feel like that conversation, the safer sex conversation, the consent conversation, the negotiations, those can be sexy. And if you're going into it thinking this is gonna break up the flow, you need to examine the flow.
right. Yeah. Well, it is so interesting that it's you know, when it comes to these kind of conversations, whether it is around negotiating consent or negotiating play, or even communicating about hooking up with someone else, you know, or hooking up with multiple partners or something like that, that, you know, definitely so many people have a struggle around, you know, just wrapping their heads around this kind of new form of communication. And I don't think that's because this is inherently an awkward thing to talk about. I think it's just because inherently most of us grew up never seeing examples of that kind of communication that was never in our media. You know, most of the sex scenes that I can recall seeing as I was growing up, it's all very, like, there's no consent talk. It's all, everyone's just kind of mind reading, and that's how it works.
Just happens.
Right. And so that's why it is so nice to have something that is in media that does just kind of demonstrate that. And I actually think that's a great segue to actually talk about the sex club scene, Jace.
Well, yeah, so that's something I was going to bring up later, but we can talk about it now. You know, I read whatever I can of other like poly content, you know, like books that people are putting out there that have polyamorous characters or things like that. And in a number of those, what I found is that there's this, there's this kind of like you're claiming that you're sort of normalizing polyamory through this book, and yet it's like very kind of overly sexualized and over like simplified, and also kind of that like, oh, we're so good at communicating that we don't have to communicate. Like we sort of mind read for each other. And I was reading a scene in one of those books where these two women who were polyamorous and also partners with each other go to a sex club, and there's this scene and it's very sexual, and it's all kind of about like how their bodies are moving and how they're feeling and what the people watching are feeling about them and all that sort of stuff. And then by contrast, I found in reading your book, there's this fantastic scene at a sex club where like the kind of the main things that the character is sort of commenting on about why this woman she's watching is so sexy is because she's like navigating consent so fluidly and like being so respectful of her partners, and you know, and she's the one who, like Emily
making
said,
sure someone has aftercare and
and she's the one, like Emily said, is the one who says that, like, thank you for taking care of yourself, and is like super respectful of those things, and just that like those attributes were the things that the character found to be so sexy. And it was so cool seeing that, because you're like, yeah, in real life, like you see someone demonstrating those traits in a kink club, you're like, that's a person I am interested in being involved with. And it's just something I hadn't ever seen before in a book that had kind of a sexy scene like that. It was really cool.
That scene just blew me away. It's probably the one that we changed the least.
Oh, really? It
just seemed to flow from him. And I just think it worked so well. I don't want to talk too much about what else happens in that scene that's important.
I know. Right. Yeah.
But I think it just builds and builds, and it's so good. And so I'm not generally a person who goes to sex clubs. That's just not really me. And I was entranced by that scene. Like, that was one of the main things that brought me into doing this and absolutely committing to it, was saying, like, wow, Kevin is such a good writer. And I can be part of that. But it's not just that, right? Like, it's everything that we've had people come up to us. And one person came up and said, hey, I had to put the book down for a second because I finally saw my polyamory on the page and it was overwhelming.
Oh, wow.
And it was so wonderful to hear that. Like, I want people to see themselves in this book. I want them to see their polycule members. I want them to see their fights, right? I want them to see their own resolutions in there as well. And I think that even just as a, like, 250-page superhero novel, that we've actually done that, that we've put so many of those things to the page that I've never seen before. I mean, I grew up reading romance novels. Like, I would borrow them from my grandmother. I would get them at yard sales. And, you know, like you said, there's a lot of mind reading, not a lot of consent in there. In fact, a lot of not a lot of consent.
Yeah.
And I got away from it because of that. Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm sort of down to the point where I maybe have, like, two romance novelists that I still follow. Mm-hmm. So I'm so happy to have something out in the world that I can read that is sexy, that has people who are making these hot connections. You know, like, I don't want to minimize that. I think it is hot, but also it's very real and it's very warm and connective, and I love it.
To piggyback off of that a little bit, like, there's something that happens in that scene, something that I really love, where like you said, there's somebody being observed in that scene, and this person being observed stops and has a little bit of a sexy moment. And there is a point where that character says something to somebody. The somebody that's spoken to nods some consent, and then this little sexy thing happens. And that was something that, like, I had forgotten until maybe, like, 2 or 3 days before we were actually, like, finalized with this book, where I looked at it and I was like, you know what? I understand that, like this is supposed to show sort of, like, the magnetism of this character being observed, and this is okay with everyone involved. But if it's not on the page, it's open to interpretation. So I added maybe, like, two sentences that put it on the page, and, like, it really doesn't take that much. Like, the bar is so low to show characters, you know, like, the bar is really low to show characters who are queer, who are polyamorous, who are people of color, who are sex positive, who are fat, who are disabled. The bar is so low to show these characters in a positive way that it should be embarrassing for folks to miss out on those things because that bar is so low. You know?
Yeah, that's a really good way of putting it. Something I also wanted to highlight is, you know, that you had multiple characters who were either gender neutral or some kind of fluid or non-conforming. You know, very early on in the book, you introduce a character whose pronoun is they. And what I noticed after I got to the end of the book is there was so little, very little, if possibly zero, if I recall correctly, like, zero emphasis on what someone's body parts were.
Even
in the sexier sections, there was very little description of, like, you know, and her tits looked like this, and his erection, his tumescence looked like this, or, you know, all the normal stuff that we see in romance novels. But instead, the sexiness was, again, more in the way, how is this person behaving? How are they acting? What is their energy? What are they saying? What are they doing? And not about, this is what their body is. And I really loved that, that there was such an emphasis on, like, you can't make assumptions about power dynamics, you can't make assumptions about gender dynamics, like, what you can see is what's actually important in this relationship, which is what is attracting this person to this other person, and it's not a question of, like, well, does that fit with their sexuality, or does that fit with, like, their genital preference or whatever? It's just like, mm-hmm. no, it's them as a human being that they find really sexy. That was also really refreshing, I found.
Yeah. But interestingly, people are telling us what gender they think that character, is, right? No,
right.
It's like, no,
right.
no, no. They're, like, they're non-binary. That's their gender. Yeah. But, you know, we've had a lot of people say something like, oh, we think that this character is a man, or we think this character is a woman. And it's just like,
how do you respond to that?
It's really interesting where, like, part of me wants, I want to defend my character. So so part of me wants to, immediately correct them on misgendering the character.
Mm-hmm.
But then another part of me is like, well, what makes you feel that way? You know? Mm-hmm. Where you've got a character who is on page and there is one minor detail. Yeah, there's one in 250 pages, there is one minor detail that designates, you know, an assigned gender at birth.
Mm-hmm.
And like it's blinking you miss it. And it's like if you don't know terminology, you'll miss it.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like that's in there, but we've had people say, like, we've had people, like, misgender the character. We've had people say, well, you know, this non-binary character is assigned male at birth or assigned female at birth. And, like, one way or the other, they're getting some of this wrong. And it's like, well, where are you coming from? You know, where are you getting this from?
Mm.
While at the same time, like, I'm glad I've written a character that can confuse the readers in that way.
Yeah. And no, and I think that's great. Like, I know that, you know, we use the word, like, confusing the reader, but I think it's a great kind of confusion, because I love that kind of confusion that snaps you out of me trying to find all these clues so I can figure out, is this a man or a woman, so that I can be more comfortable, like, as a cisgender person, you know, being able to figure out clearly what kind of body this is, but instead that it is confusing enough that it's like, you can't spend too much energy trying to figure out, because it also doesn't really matter.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Like, somebody else's body should not matter to you. Someone else's, how someone designated them when they were born should not matter to you, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? But interestingly, so Kevin and I, we do a talk about representation sort of in general, and we talk about John Scalzi's book. Which
we're gonna
lock in.
I feel bad because I feel like I'm spoiling this, but it's not a spoiler. It has nothing to do with the story. The story never tells you whether the main character is a man, a woman. Mm-hmm. Never tells you if the character is white or black or Latin. And I have talked to so many people about that book because I've recommended it. I love that book. And it's been fascinating to see who read through the entire book without changing their mind of what their first sort of casting of the character was.
Interesting.
And that's not what we're doing here at all, right? Like, when we talk, you know, if the word trick came up in terms of, like, because like, confusing the reader is one thing, but no one is here to trick the reader.
Right.
Yeah. Non-binary people are not here to trick anyone.
Mm-hmm.
That is insulting and horrible, right? So so while Scalzi brings up a lot of things in his book, like the way we bring our own perceptions to what we read, this character, Voss, does not do that. Voss is a character who exists in that world and is a person and needs to be treated as a person, which is why we took so much care and, you know, we talked to our non-binary friends and family and partners, and we made sure that there was nothing in the book that didn't feel at least accurate to somebody at some point.
Right.
Like that one little detail that made it into the book, we debated that, you know, where we had a long conversation about it, because there was the idea that if it doesn't matter, maybe we don't need this detail.
Right.
Mm-hmm. But then we spoke with Alana's kid, who also identifies as non-binary, and we wanted to make sure, like, hey, we're getting consultants on this one, and the decision was made that this one detail represents a normal facet of somebody's life, and that's important to show. That's as important to show as it would be to leave out. So we left that part in, and it worked, you know. And some people catch it, some people don't, and it's fine either way.
Right.
Yeah. Could I ask again, which John Scalzi book was it that you were talking about?
Lock in.
Okay, because I just read two other John Scalzi books from his series after that, the Interdependency series, and was talking about those a few episodes ago. But anyway, yeah, that's cool. I haven't read the Lock In Universe stuff. I'll have to check that out.
Something that was weird about that is, like, if you pre-ordered the book on Audible, which I did, because I like Scalzi, you got two versions of the book if you pre-ordered it. You got one with a male narrator and one with a female narrator.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
And I listened to both versions back to back, and in my head, the main character, Chris, was a black dude. Like, there was one detail about the character that said, this is a black dude. Mm-hmm. And I listened to both versions of the book, and that was like, this is a black dude. And it wasn't until years later when Alana's like, yeah, they never give up, you know, gender or race on the character. I was like, yeah, they do. But wait, no, they don't. And then, you know,
that's great. No, that's very cool.
That's fascinating. Cool. Well, speaking of a broader range of sci-fi universes and authors, have any of you, I mean, have the two of you, are you familiar with Stranger in a Strange Land? The Heinlein novel from 1961,
I think. Yeah.
I've
heard of it.
So this was such a funny experience for me because I read Stranger in a Strange Land and finished it right before I started reading your book. So I kind of got these two interesting sci-fi books back to back. And
interesting.
I will say, just to give a disclaimer for anyone who's listening and who hasn't read it yet, it's very much a product of its time. It's extremely homophobic, extremely sexist, has just a lot of issues with it. However, it was extremely, extremely influential on the free love movement and on a lot of people who would go on to end up writing more about non-monogamy and polyamory and relationships without jealousy and stuff like that. So that was kind of the cool parts. It's kind of wrapped up again in kind of this inherent, like, racist, transphobic, you know, homophobic kind of rhetoric. But it was a kind of a little bit of a palate cleanser reading your book right afterwards, because then it's like, okay, well, here's a world where those things aren't necessarily, first and foremost.
They're not existent. Yeah.
I do think it's interesting looking at this kind of recurring pattern of sci-fi being the medium for introducing concepts that can have a revolutionary impact on our present day lives. Mm-hmm. You know, I see it with looking back at Stranger in a Strange Land, where it was kind of like the first major popular fiction book, I think, to have this big rhetoric about, you know, jealousy not being based in love, and that having sex and being in love with multiple people is okay and can be healthy, and if anything, could, you know, possibly be a better choice for many people. And kind of mirroring in the same way, like the two of you have done in this book, of, you know, it's a sci-fi setting, but having this kind of representation is not something that's, like, inaccessible to us in a modern day setting, essentially.
Yeah, I know we wanted to make sure that our setting, while sci-fi, it wasn't that sci. It was, you know. I mean, yeah, it's a superhero novel, but we kept it very rooted in reality. I made a couple of references to, like, modern day pop culture and everything like that. Because a lot of this is how our lives look. I've got queer friends that joke around and say, like, I haven't seen a straight person in, like, 3 weeks. And I know that's how I am, where, like, there are days that go by where I don't run into any monogamous people, you know, like, outside of, like, work, you know? Like, I get my coffee from a monogamous person and go home with my polyamorous existence. And we wanted to make sure that, like, if we were going to do this representation-wise, we were going to show it in a world that can exist, and, like, a world that is accepting. And keeping it rooted in a very close reality. Like, I don't say it out loud very often, but like, the main city that this all takes place in, Cargill, New Jersey, is basically just a fictionalized Newark, but the rest of the rest of America is still the rest of America.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was like, is it New York? But no, it's not quite. Okay, it's Newark,
New Jersey,
Newark.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah, there you go. Just over the, I guess.
Yeah, it's what, right over there's the bridge. Like a,
the bridge, yeah.
Just over the bridge.
Something separating those two.
Yeah. For a long time now, we've been fans of AdamandEve.com for getting sex toys or lingerie or accessories, things like that. It's just a fantastic resource with a huge selection. And now, not only do we have a fantastic offer, but we also have a promo code that will work on adammail.com and evestoys.com, which are their sites specifically for LGBTQ audiences. And our code is fantastic. It's 50% off of almost any item in the store and free discreet shipping when you use our code MULTI.
Yes, we love adamandeve.com and have for years. They are our oldest and longest sponsor, and they just keep on giving great gifts to us and to our listeners. You can bring more pleasure and satisfaction into your bedroom by going to adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com and select any one item. It can be, you know, an adventurous new toy or anything you desire, something fun, something sexy, whatever sounds good.
So just enter offer code MULTI at checkout and you'll get 50% off almost any item plus free shipping. That's MULTI, MULTI, at adamandeve.com, adammail.com, or evestoys.com. This is an exclusive offer that is specific to this podcast, and it's better than any offer that is currently available on their site. So again, use code MULTI to get you not just the 50% discount, but also the 100% free shipping. Code MULTI.
So something that I did find really interesting about this, and I know Emily and Dedeker have both mentioned it, is just this idea of kind of creating a world where it seems like, at least from the slice of the world that we get to see, that things like racism and sexism also aren't something that's like a big plague on this world like it is on ours. And yeah. It reminded me of a talk that I went to just recently about representation in media that was at PatriCon that I went to a couple months ago now, I guess, like a month ago. And the woman who was hosting that, she hosts a channel that's all about games, like tabletop games as well as video games. And they got a lot of questions about Dungeons & Dragons campaigns. And like representation in those. And it kind of led to this whole discussion about this idea that, you know, whether we're talking about elves and dwarves and orcs and whatever, or we're sci-fi where we're talking about Romulans and Klingons and whatever, that we're still kind of taking all of our baggage that we have in our modern life and just doing it again with different colors and shapes on it. And she was really encouraging people to be like, we don't have to do that. Like, we get to create these worlds. Can't we find other things to have conflict over or like other things to be concerned about? And so she was really coming down to that. And then reading your book shortly after that, just kind of being like, hey, you know what? This is kind of an example of that, of like not having to make the fact that, you know, one of the recurring characters in the book has they pronouns, that wasn't like the issue that anyone was contending with, right? And just what it's like, if you're going to read fantasy or sci-fi and be in another world, like why not have it be a world where we can take a break from some of the shit that we have here?
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I like that Kev did was he basically created a timeline for the world where it shows you that these things exist and they happen, but also that there has been more pushback against it for such a longer time, which was another one of the big things that drew me in. But when we first started, I was like, but Kev, if we're in a world without racism, and he just kept like sighing at me because that's not what he created. What he created was a world that's willing to push back more. And that sort of optimism and that sort of activism makes this world special, and it makes it aspirational.
Yeah.
A thing that's sort of inherently oppressive about sci-fi is that, like, a lot of science fiction just sort of theorizes that they're in a world without bigotry, in a world without racism, or, you know, or ableism, or, you know, or one thing or another. That's sort of like the theory of this, of the narrative, but they never examine why. And the character, and like the, and the story almost always still follows like a cisgender heterosexual white man, you know, whether it's sci-fi or fantasy. So like, if these things don't exist, why are we still following the same exact characters?
Right.
If these things don't exist, why don't they exist? And why is the power structure the same? So we created a timeline where superheroes take the front line in terms of social change, you know? So it's not just people with privilege using their platforms. It's people with, like, straight up superpowers using their platforms. So like, the first superhero is a guy in the 1960s, is a black guy in the 1960s, who also says, like, hey, if you want me to keep this community safe with my powers, cool, but you got to get rid of all these racist white cops around here.
Right.
And that creates a culture shift where every superhero says, well, I want to use my powers. I want to use my powers for good. But also, you know, what's up with this equal pay for women? What's up with this body positivity? What's up with this housing reform? And each, you know, and like, superheroes sort of take a responsibility to use their platform. So like, they're not just saving the day, they're saving the world. And that's sort of where they come from. So in the modern day that Operator is set in, there's, you know, racism exists, but it's lessened, and there's a reason why, you know? Homophobia, transphobia, bigotry in general, those things still exist, but it's, you know, it's more likely that you're going to find somebody who is mildly suppressed by way of identity than completely oppressed by way of identity. And it's a world that pushes back on that, and like, actively so. And that's why the main characters of Operator are women of color, because if we're living in a world that has less barriers in place for women of color, then the main characters can be women of color, and it's not a strange thing. Right. Like, our two main characters are the best they are their best there is at what they do, to quote the Wolverine line, you know? So it's not a weird thing.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. It's interesting the way you described your superheroes. You know, these people who, you know, want to help their communities, but they also have interest in pushing back against these things, pushing back against the racist, you know, cops, pushing back against all these obstacles in place, you know, for equal pay for women. And it's kind of funny that it's kind of like, in an ideal world, that's what our politicians should be for us.
Yeah.
But clearly we're not living in an ideal world.
No,
no, we are not.
So Kevin has, in this timeline, Kevin has this very important legal battle that goes on, and one of the people involved is in a polyamorous relationship. And so that person's fame helps normalize the concept of ethical non-monogamy, and that's why when you see our characters, they can choose what their default is, rather than having a default put on them by society, which would be monogamy usually, right? But right, in this case, people are people talk about it. It doesn't mean that cheating's gone, right? So this is the same thing as Kev was talking about in terms of transphobia and racism. Instead, you have this whole thing where someone goes into a relationship and they have that conversation. Oh, do you want an open relationship? Do you not want an open relationship? And you don't see that particularly happening on the page in this book, right?
Right.
But it is a part of this whole world, is that people are communicating more about relationship types because they have some people that they have looked up to. Right. So if we had the people that we have now who are in the media, if we had had them decades ago, where would we be now? And that's sort of where this book is.
Right.
Yeah, that conversation happens in those first 10 chapters.
Yeah.
The same time, I just wanted to really quickly point out that I do appreciate, like you mentioned earlier, Alana, that these characters also don't have it down perfectly. Like, there's still some fights, there's still some arguments that come sometimes by accident, by just, oh, mm-hmm. I didn't know how to communicate this thing, or, oh, yep. I thought that this would be okay, and, oh, it turns out it wasn't okay, which that felt very much like, oh, I know that, I've been there, you know, mm-hmm. it's not
and
quite...
And there was, like, don't ask, don't tell in there right. in a certain way, which was really interesting, and I was like, is this a metaphor for something? Like, yeah, I enjoyed that, too. So these were definitely yeah. real people.
And we wanted to make sure that those conflicts read as real to us because, mm-hmm. like, the way, like, say, love triangles get played out in a lot of fiction, they don't read as real to us because we're polyamorous folks, you know, where we see, you know, Katniss is into PETA and Gale, and she gets two completely different things out of both of them, you know?
Cool, be with both of them.
Yeah, exactly. But instead, they always find a way to kill a character or make someone leave or make someone evil or make somebody a mystery sibling somehow. You know?
Right.
They find some way to cancel the triangle so that a choice never has to be made. Whereas our characters, they find themselves in a conflict, but the conflict isn't the existence of multiple relationships. Right. The conflict is the particular dynamics of the characters. Mm-hmm. And that's how they approach it, and that's how they resolve it.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it does sound like, obviously, at the end of the book even, there will be more to come from these characters. So do you have, like, an idea of where their story is going to go? Do you already, like, have everything mapped out, or do you think it's going to be more of an organic process? And when will we see more from these characters?
So the next book is actually going to follow two completely different characters.
Oh, wow.
I said to Kev, I'm like, oh, it would be so easy to go jump into fleshing out that what ended up being the prequel, right?
Right.
Let's do that. Let's do, you know, it's called Supercell right now. That's the working title. Let's do Supercell. It's probably going to be called Supercell. And Kev was like, if we do that, then people are going to think that all we're going to do is interact with these characters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's not where he wanted us to be. And I agree with him now. Even though I do think Supercell probably would have been faster to push to completion.
Oh, yeah, without a doubt.
Without, you know, like right now we're dealing with all these new characters and how they relate to the world. And so it's very different.
Getting new consultants.
And, you know, and just making sure that's all accurate too and working on that plot. But we do know, generally speaking, where we're going for the next 5 or 6 books.
Hmm. Yeah.
And a lot of them are sort of all happening around the same time.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not that kind of series.
I think, like, Operator happens between about, like, April and January, like, 2018 to 2019. I don't even know if we put years on it, but it's like...
I think it's 2017 to 2018.
Okay. I'll take your word for it. It's from about April to January. Whereas the next book that we're working on is that same year from about April to October.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so kind of overlapping stories.
Yeah, and while there are characters and elements that are gonna recur, like you might see a character that you're familiar with and see them at a different angle,
right.
But it won't be their story this time. Mm-mm.
Okay, so I have a question. Okay. I want to hear answers from both of you. So if in writing the next book in this series, you decide to take a break halfway through to write another book on an entirely different genre, what genre is that going to be?
So that would absolutely be our cautionary poly book, Cautionary Polyamory, which is based on our workshop, Cautionary Polyamory.
Nice.
Because that's the book I wanted him to do first, and he wouldn't listen to me.
I will agree with Elena, because Elena will be very upset with me if I disagree with her. We were supposed to jump in working on the Cautionary Poly book, and I really wanted to stay in for hire. And I think we have a really good foundation to get that Cautionary Poly book off the ground. But I wanted to, I like what we're doing with For Hire, and I wanted to stay in that universe a little bit longer before we shifted gears to something else. But also, there's still stuff left over for Operator. We are currently recording an audiobook. We've got a great voice actress involved. And So she's currently recording that. And also we're working on some DLC because, like you said, I'm a gamer. So there's a bit towards the end that required a character flip, a change in perspective. And it's something that was, there was a change in perspective in the first draft and we got rid of that. I'm trying to put it back in, but it no longer fits where it fit before. So the game plan is that we're rewriting this change of perspective and we're going to release it with the audio, like recorded with the audiobook and also digitally for anybody who wants it. You know, anyone who's read either a paperback or ebook, whatever copy of Operator they have, or release it for free just to put it out there. So then there's a little bit of extra content there.
Excellent. Nice, very cool.
Yeah, some DLC, some custom skins. Yeah, super exciting. Great.
So Kevin and Alana, we would love to know where we can find more of both of your work. Kevin, obviously we had you on a couple months ago promoting Love is Not Colorblind, but what else can we expect from the two of you and where can we find your work?
Well, I'm still Poly Role Models pretty much everywhere. I'm Poly Role Models on YouTube, Patreon, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. Most of my stuff is on Facebook. I'm currently on Tumblr. I don't know how long that's going to last, though.
Yeah, so is it, like, going away? Going out of business?
I mean, yeah, they're getting rid of their adult content. I don't think Poly Role Models counts as adult content, but those filters have been big and sweeping. The nets have been catching a lot of stuff that doesn't have adult content. So I don't know if I'm going to be allowed to stay there. And I'm not sure that I'd want to continue supporting a platform that would commit these sort of changes. Yeah. So that might be a change. Now, for hire as a novel and as a series, you can find that at For Hire Mag on Twitter and facebook.com/ForHireMag. The book's Operator is available on Amazon as an ebook, on Amazon as a paperback, and basically everywhere, Amazon, Kobo, Sony, Barnes & Noble's, Smashwords as an ebook.
Awesome.
So you can find me online as the Polyamorous Librarian. I'm on WordPress. I am on Patreon. I'm on Facebook. And then on Twitter, I have a different name because I started my Twitter so long ago. It's Hello Librarian.
Cute.
All right. Well, thank you both again so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Yeah, we really appreciate that.